Welcome to this weekend's Nevada Backcountry Show. Shout out to show sponsors, Rightful Liberty Arms, Shooting Performance Institute, Truck Envy, Battleborn Tree Service, and I believe, I haven't heard from Michael, but I believe there are still some Nevada Backcountry hats over at Rightful Liberty Arms. Hey, go in, buy a box of ammo, $50 or more, and you get a free Nevada Backcountry hat.
Like and they're I sweet.
Said, they are pretty cool.
Dave, they are sweet.
Let's see, housekeeping stuff, Dave. I got a couple of emails. I'm going to preface this with, look, I'm a weird-looking white dude with a Jerry curl. You could call me the Kenny Powers of hunting media. Yes, I consumed alcohol and shot a shotgun in Argentina. I understand that might not be the best representation.
It's Argentina.
I know, man.
It's Argentina.
Well,
I mean,
Like,
I guarantee you can't get away with having children being your bird dogs in the U.S.
Oh, 100% no.
But this it's Argentina.
Yeah, look, maybe I shouldn't have put that out there. I got a couple emails on it as far as not being a good representative of hunting. Again, look, this is an opinion show. I'm a regular dude. I just am really passionate about hunting. Sometimes I don't think of myself as a representative of the hunting community.
Yeah, I guess, well, coming from that point, we are kind of, in a sense. But still, yeah. It's Argentina.
As soon as you cross international borders, judgment and good decision-making leaves the room.
Oh, completely.
Anyway, I wanted to address that. Do as I say, not as I do.
Yes.
Let's see. Oh, bad news, Dave. Two different states, the National Elk Refuge in Wyoming, confirmed CWD in the herd.
Yes.
And they had to euthanize a cow. Now, CWD, always fatal.
Yeah, no matter what.
You probably know better than I do. I tend to think of CWD as a deer disease.
Well, it is.
No, it is, right, it right. Is. But yeah. I've never heard of it getting into elk herds.
Yeah, well, elk, I mean, it's the same. They're all the same family. Elk,
right.
Caribou, moose, deer, they're all the same deal there. So I don't think it's transmissible, a mule deer to an elk or a mule deer to caribou or something in that fashion.
Okay.
They can get the disease.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's the first time I ever heard of it in an elk herd.
Yeah. I do remember reading about another case where it got into an elk herd and they had to euthanize quite a few of the animals. It was quite some time ago. It was probably okay. 5 or so years ago, and it had gotten into a herd. And I can't remember. I think it was a management herd, like a high fence herd.
Oh, yeah, where this stuff spreads like wildfire.
Yeah, they were all in a high fence hunting right. ranch situation.
Gotcha.
They had to euthanize a good chunk of their elk.
Obviously, this isn't a high fence situation. However, it is the National Elk Refuge where multiple herds all come together.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, not good to hear. And
it's good that they found it, though. And they're going to get into some serious monitoring. And if anything starts getting hinky, they'll pull those animals and euthanize them. You just can't draw blood and be like, yep, this one's positive. You got to take some brain tissue.
Right.
I mean, they could do that to you or I, and we'd be fine, but I got a lot to spare.
Yeah. So there's no, like you said, that's not like a quick little blood test. You got to get in there and root around.
You got to do some work.
And then more bad news on a national level, folks, none of this in Nevada yet. A bunch of elk herds in Montana have mange. As we were talking about before the show, it's a mite illness, but essentially I believe that it tends to not manifest. What word do I want to? It shows up when a herd is stressed or an animal is stressed.
Correct.
So either lack of available forage or water or something.
Exactly.
That's when their body basically can't fight it off.
Yeah, can't get rid of that. There's something going on there. I mean, it's Montana and Wyoming as well.
Yeah.
Their elk herds are kind of going bonkers.
Yeah, exploding.
Just
in
exploding.
Numbers, yeah.
So when you start having that large of an animal exploding like that, you're probably going to have some territorial stressors.
I don't know for sure, but I believe most of the West was under that real, it was a weird light winter across the West.
Oh, yeah, completely.
So
the East Coast got absolutely slammed.
Yes.
And the West, we got just a trickle.
Yeah, right. So
it's going to be a very, very dry year this year.
We'll go into that on this this weekend's episode. Tag applications, hopefully everybody, Wednesday the 13th at 11 p.m. That closed. So we will also go into tag allocation numbers on this show. We got a bunch of stuff coming up. I guess this first segment's going to be a little more meandering. You were just on a project out there in Fallon for the MODIS system. Am I saying
MODIS
that right?
MODIS towers.
MODIS towers.
Yeah.
Explain that real quick. Yeah. We don't have to go in depth.
So a MODIS tower is basically it's a tower that has multiple antennas, up to 6 to 9 antennas, put in different directions. And as you get up there, you'll use it and you'll move those to where they get their best signals. This MODIS tower will pick up animals that have been tagged. So there's a little MODIS tag. You can put it on bats, all the way down to bats, to waterfowl, to shorebirds, to passerine birds, to anything you want to track or follow.
Predominantly used for winged stuff?
No, no, not necessarily. They'll use it for mammals. You can tag, put them on deer. You can put them on anything you want.
Gotcha.
You know, they're different sizes and such. But these things in an optimal area, you know, big valley that goes for miles and miles, you can actually pick up these little itty bitty tags, which are about the size of your pinky nail.
Okay.
Up to 10 miles.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's wild. So it will ping the tower that tag is in the area, and it can track the direction the tag is going, the distance away from the tower. It provides you with all this fantastic metadata. Then it's downloaded onto, you know, the satellites and the cloud, and we can download that data and analyze it. So it's kind of like a summer student that doesn't complain or bitch or call in. It's just out there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's national. These MODIS towers are all over the country as well as all over the world, helping track different species.
And here's why you said this and you explained what it was to me. There was that connection between personal life and then what you were doing out there, because my kids love those FAHLO, follow bracelets, where you get a little QR code and it tracks a giraffe or an elephant or a shark or whatever. And I always thought, I mean, when we go to a zoo or whatever, my kids are like, I want this as a souvenir. I'm like, okay, cool. But I always thought they were bogus. And I was like, oh, whatever, man. They're just making up little pins and stuff. Apparently not.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, the technology in the world of science is moving at such a pace. It's almost like AI.
Yeah.
You know, there's these AI algorithms. AI is creating all these different programmings and processes at a rate that a lot of science can't even keep up with it. It's just really cool to get out there and see this stuff happening and being fortunate enough to be one of the leads on building these units. And, you know, because some of these, Nevada's pretty remote. Ever been out there. So a lot of the MODIS towers in a lot of places, they plug into a building we're designing, myself and my colleague, designing like solar systems with inverters and everything so that these systems can run. And then we have to download it into a program that runs off the satellites or a cell network, you know, Wi-Fi, or whatever it may be that we can actually connect with. So it makes it tough sometimes to actually like, hey, this would be a great place to put a tower because this is a great migration area, corridor of some sort.
We're the like, Sheldon or something.
Right, you know, something like that. And you're like, oh man, how are we going to power this thing? And where's it going to send the information? So there's all kinds of things because you don't want to get a system where you've got to go out every few months, download the data physically.
Right.
Go there, plug into it, download it because, you know, as you know. Yeah, Nevada, yeah. You're like, oh, hey, I'm going to go download this thing for 15 minutes, but I got to drive 7 hours.
On a dirt road that's washed out.
Exactly. So there's other processes. It's a really cool program. I'm really digging it. I'm having a good time.
Do not go anywhere. Coming up, we're going to get into tag allocations. We'll do a quick trip report on Knott Creek Reservoir. We'll go into the commission meeting. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Back to Nevada Backcountry on this Sunday. A little more grab bag stuff before we dive into the commission meeting and tag allocations. Knott Creek Reservoir. As you and I talked before the show, Dave, there's a lot of places I'll call it guarded,
Yeah. As far secretive.
Yeah. Cagey about kind of coughing up where I was, what I caught it on, how I fished it, because they're accessible.
Yeah.
And they're maybe, in my estimation, can't withstand a ton of pressure before it kind of goes to crap. So I'm like, yeah, I'm going to keep my mouth shut.
Yeah, it's
shut
like chucker spots or a good deer spot or something like that. Yeah, it's like, you know, what do they call it? Oh, over there at Hidden Mountain or what do they call it? You know,
north of Gerlach. That's everything for me.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man, you guys got some birds. Where'd you go? North of Gerlach.
Yep. Yeah, done.
Leave it at that.
Yep.
But I will talk about this last weekend. I was out at Knot Creek Reservoir.
Yeah.
Absolutely phenomenal. And the reason I'm going to talk about it real quick on the show is because, one, it is so remote. Two, the access is fairly rough.
Yeah.
So I just kind of go, I'll talk about it. If you are willing to put in the work and pay for the gas to get out there, kudos to you, and I'll give you some insider tips on it. Smallest fish I think we touched was in that like 16-inch range. Yeah. Largest, almost 25 on the nose.
And those were all tigers. Maybe a few rainbows, but mainly
rainbows
tigers.
And tigers.
Yeah.
You know what? I've never caught a brown out of there, but supposedly there are browns in there.
Yeah, there are. That hasn't been stocked with browns in a long time.
Okay.
But there's still some residual ones kind of cruising around in there.
Okay.
But yeah, only thing I've ever caught in there
tigers
in the
and
last
rainbows.
Few years has been tigers and rainbows.
Yeah. Not a small fish to be found.
No. I mean, it's such a great reservoir. And it's nice when you pop up and over and drop into that zone. You're like, where did this place show up?
It's
like an oasis of just, you mean you got aspen stands and green.
And the rock formation, it's very, I was going to call it Tolkien-esque.
Yeah.
It's like dropping into something out of the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
With all the rock formations and the greenery. And I just drove through Leonard Creek Ranch and all, you know, that flat desert out there. And now I'm in this lush green bowl with a reservoir. It's amazing. So for those of you that want to head up to Knot Creek Reservoir, I'd highly encourage it. The fishing was absolutely incredible. John and I put a hurting on them. And I would tell people, full sink line, about 8 to 10 foot leader, and then a black mohair leech, or of all things, a white and chartreuse booby. Those were the flies of the weekend.
That's what they were hitting.
That's what
you said
hitting.
You tried like a woolly bugger and they just had no interest in it.
No, woolly buggers weren't working. I tried olive brown, you know, all the kind of standby. I tried white wing stuff, like a duck wing, a sheep creek, bunch of different stuff.
I was
going
to ask if you did try a sheep creek.
Oh, yeah. Even some of the old New England stuff, like zug bug.
Zug bugs,
I tried that. Yeah. But white booby with a chartreuse body and tail, and then a black mohair leech.
Mohair. Okay.
Real thin sucker.
Yeah.
That was
the money.
It was awesome.
It's such a great place.
And full sink line. I tried an intermediate line one day and had a little bit of success, but nothing like going over to that. Yeah, you know what? I'm going to get real specific for a minute. I'd kick my float tube over that island.
Yeah.
Cast straight at the rocks from about 50 yards out. I'd count down to 20 with a full sink line, and then I'd just slow 3 to 6 inch strips and just banging them. It was awesome.
It's awesome.
So there you go, folks.
Yeah, I wonder if
make the drive out.
Yeah, I wonder if they're deep because we have had like very little winter, so that upper area, that upper thermal is just probably too warm.
I think that top 5 or 6 feet of the water column's pretty dang warm.
Yeah.
You'd see them in the morning rising, and then you'd see them kind of at that last light. They would be rising down by the dam.
Yeah, just because of the bugs.
Right. But other as far that, as big bug activity, not a ton. It was definitely a full sink and slow strip game.
That's awesome.
Let's see. Where do we... You want to go into the commission meeting real quick?
Yeah, commission last week.
Yes. Thank you, Dave. Yeah. You did the legwork on that. You did all the work on that. I just had to stand up and talk. And I got to be honest, I was a little nervous at first.
Really? Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I got up there and was kind of like, you know, you're looking up at all these people. You're down there at the lectern. And I realized I was like, I had drifted off. Because it got kind of long-winded. So it was like, I was dialed. I had practiced. I was like, okay, this one I'm going to say. This is what they're going to ask.
You did a great job. You did a great job presenting the presentation. So what was proposed, the proposal that was set forth was to remove the 80% let off from the archery regulation 503.144.
Yes.
So I think some of the people that commented on it online as well as in person may have gotten a few things a little hinky, because we did mention manufacturers are sending bows out like standard 85-90% let up.
Right.
That was not the driving element for this regulation. The main crux of this regulation was that it is absolutely and completely unenforceable. Why have it on the books?
The game warden that was with me, Jake Kearney?
Kramer.
Kramer.
Yeah, Jake Kramer even said, no, there's...
Can't
it's
unenforced.
We can't enforce it. And all the years that it's been there, it's been on the books for decades or so,
Yeah.
They've never cited anyone for it.
Right.
Because it is unenforceable. There's no way of measuring it. There's no way of legally, they're not going to put that in front of a judge.
You can pick it apart. The scale calibration. If there's a human being, and that's the point I tried to make during the thing, you can pull harder into that back wall and cook it so it shows the holding weight's higher.
Correct. On those handheld, last chance H2s.
Bingo.
Or
you're
going
to take an archer that you suspect has higher let off. You're going to make them drive to the nearest town with a bow shop with an actual draw board and take the human. It's just insane.
Well, and then they would have to get a certification that that thing's been calibrated recently.
Right.
So, and realistically, let off does not make you a better bow hunter. It increases comfort on the back end when you're holding. So you can hold the bow a little bit longer.
Right.
You know, there is argument like, well, it makes shooting a bow easier. Well, no, because you still have to break that bow over its maximum weight. You still have to pull that cam over 60, 70, 80 pounds. So anyway, long story short, it was approved.
Yeah,
8-1. One individual wasn't really stoked. I don't know why, but they weren't. But that's okay. So it moved forward, and now they are going to commission, will ask Endow Law Enforcement Division to provide more information. So you and I who proposed this, only way that we would have to go and redo anything is if the game wardens or law enforcement needs us to answer questions.
Right.
So now it's all up to the Law Enforcement Division to either fight for it or just say, let's just dump this thing.
Well, and I feel like it was fairly straightforward. Basically, it's a removal of verbiage.
That's it.
There's no, you don't have to come up with something new. You don't have to,
you're done.
Select it, delete, good to go.
You know, and like the commission had stated, they wanted, because a few folks online were concerned about the definition of primitive weapons. Well, Nevada doesn't have a definition for a primitive weapon. We're not like Idaho or Montana that has a stick and string hunt.
Yeah.
Like a true traditional longbow recurve hunt.
Primitive hunt.
Primitive bare bow hunt.
Well, even their muzzle loaders. We've talked about my dad having to dumb down his muzzle loader to hunt in Idaho.
Yeah, because some of them it's flintlock.
No
like,
sabos,
it's lead ball, the whole nine yards, cloth, the whole bit. Nevada doesn't. I mean, when they say archery is all inclusive. It is minus crossbows, because crossbows aren't real bows. But it is longbow, recurve, compound.
Yep.
That's archery. I think that was something that will probably get addressed at the next commission, was because they were like, well, we need to know what the definition between them are. Well,
a member of the public on Zoom brought up something to do with that was kind of against removing it. If I remember correctly, I think that was coming from that trad camp.
Correct.
Is where that came from.
Yeah. And that was the issue. That's why it didn't pass in Montana.
Right.
Because they have such a strong traditional archery group.
They have
there.
An actual primitive season and primitive hunts.
Yeah. Right. And it's totally separate. So, and this wasn't a regulation about nostalgia. This is just cleaning up the regs that the governor requested when he first came into office, went to all the departments and all the agencies, and said, clean up all of the regulations that are garbage.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't say it in those words, but basically get rid of the stuff that
doesn't make sense.
That doesn't make sense, that can't be done anymore, can't be enforced, no one uses it anymore. Get rid of all that stuff, because there are a god-awful amount of regulations and laws, and there's a buttload of them that just are dead. They just, you know, stuff they made up, you know, that they created back in the 50s and 60s.
Don't spit
and stuff
on the sidewalks.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Whatever.
Like,
no.
You know,
no, yeah, yeah.
When you get out of prison, you get a bag of gold and a horse. You know, that was...
Probably do away with that.
That's a good one to get rid of after a prisoner actually asked for it.
So, 8-1, got it passed. Moving on. Coming up on the show, tag allocations.
2026.
Bunch of changes there. So, do not go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. If you are in need of a tune-up this season, go see Jim at Shooting Performance Institute. The Hunter's Challenge 3D course with guns is actually going on as we speak. If you need ammo, guns, whatever, go see Rightful Liberty Arms. Get yourself that free Nevada backcountry hat. Go to Truck Envy. Get your rig set up for the season. And last but not least, give Mike and the gang a call at Battleborn Tree Service. Get your property taken care of before you head out to start scouting for the tags that I'm sure you are all going to draw. Now, tags, Dave, let's talk about tag allocations this year. There are a ton of changes.
Yeah, there are. Well, there's a bunch of new hunts, some changes in relation to youth tags.
Correct.
For horns shorter than ears, as well as deer.
Yep.
Across the board, I mean, everything kind of went up a chunk.
It swung in hunter's favor, I feel like.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I really think so, too. Going through all the data, it's a lot more opportunities in relation to increased tags in a lot of different animal classes.
Right.
You know, certain ones like bighorn sheep and stuff, there's some cuts, there's some drops, as well as there's new hunts, like those management hunts. I mean, there's 18 brand new tags for
18
for that new management hunt.
Up in
066.
We talked about that. I think both you and I thought it'd be like two or three tags.
Yeah.
Just a couple. 18.
I'm glad I put in for it.
Same.
But, you know, other than that, the antelope tags are up across the board. You know, one of the big things was the youth horns shorter than ears. The commission, the department was recommending that 50% of all the tags go to the youth hunts, the youth hunters. And the commission originally wanted it to be 70.
And kudos to Mel Belding, who got up and spoke at the commission meeting.
Oh, heck yeah.
He was in favor of giving them all, like, he wanted a big increase for youth hunters on that horn shorter.
On that horn shorter than ears. Yeah, he did a great job. And they went with 60 for this year.
Yeah, I'll take it.
And most likely next year, it'll probably be bumped up some more. So youth hunters, you have a fantastic opportunity to get a horn shorter than ears tag. I wouldn't mind seeing, to be honest, this is my David's two cents is,
let's hear
I would like to see the horn shorter than ears tag also be mixed in with, adults that are wanting to get into hunting, like first time people ever putting in for a tag.
Oh, I would go there with
you. Like anyone like 18 and up or 19 years of age and up who are like, hey, I want to get into hunting. There's a lot of studies showing that folks that get into hunting later in life that don't end up getting tags end up petering out and they go into like golf or pickleball or squash or something. They're like, okay, this ain't going to work out. So they're gone. So we're losing that opportunity. So this would be a great opportunity to, you know, if it's your first time ever putting in for a tag, you can put in
for
that.
Would that be pretty easy to implement and track? Because, I mean,
it'd be easy to track because you can see, like, you can go into your portal.
Right.
And it'll show you, my first tag I put in for was 1980.
Everything I've ever applied for is on there.
So if you're a brand new hunter and you've never put in, it will see, and it's only residents. It would have to be only residents,
first-time hunters and youth hunters.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this may make me sound elitist, but it's a horns shorter hunt.
Yeah, I mean, it gives people an opportunity to get out there, experience it. So, but that's my two cents. But right now, it's pretty heavy on, it's a 60-40 split between youth and any legal weapon hunt.
Right.
So that was awesome.
I just can't see, if you're an adult pushing back on something like that because you just got to get out and do a horns shorter hunt, even though you've been hunting for 20 years, give me a break. Go sing it to somebody else. First timers and kids.
Yeah. I mean, I think it'd be a great idea.
Anyway.
But that's just it.
Yep.
So the antelope really doing well. Tags are up across the board for antelope. Some elk areas, obviously, are down.
Right.
Even with elk, with antlerless, with cow elk. Tags are down, even though the populations are doing really well. But some areas, it's a hit or miss. But across the board, elk tags went up a little bit. Not a ton, but it did go up a little bit in certain areas. The sixes and sevens and the elevens and that. So
Well, so, I think on that, Dave, mm-hmm. what I think a lot of people don't take into consideration, right? They just see this number and they think that's indicative of how many animals are in the herd. Whereas,
right.
you know, that plays into it. But at the same time, the habitat condition plays into it.
Oh, big time.
So there's a lot of that, too, where they may raise the number of tags they give out for an area. And it's simply it's not necessarily indicative of the number of animals in the herd, but what kind of forage conditions there are on the landscape where they're going, we are not going to be able, this herd is not going to be able to sustain itself over the winter in this environment. We need to make sure we get this to a manageable number so we don't have a bunch of starvation or die off.
Oh, exactly. Because of fires and such. We've seen plenty of fires come through areas and herds are great there. They just, with the lack of
there's
habitat
nothing to
now
eat.
Nothing to eat, no cover, no nothing.
Gotta get them out of there.
Yeah. I mean your numbers completely shift.
Yeah.
You know, in relation to the animals and the habitat, you know.
And I'd rather see people get out and fill their freezers than see 20, 30 animals starve to death over a hard winter. So jack the tags up, all for it.
Oh yeah. So elk are doing really well. Again, depending on where you are, you can look at it and see that it does have a relation to our droughts as well as our wildfires that have gone through the state in the last couple of years. Because it takes a while for all that to regenerate. But there's certain areas in the state that we had fires back in the early 2000s and stuff. And now, amazing.
Going like gangbusters.
Oh, yeah. And the elk herds are just exploding in those areas. So, so that's cool. But the next stuff is some of the cooler stuff here. We have a increase in our moose tags. They increased it by one tag. So now we have three moose tags. So
people can't see. My jaw dropped and my face started. My eyes lit up.
So now I'm going to have two other people out there with me
this
year.
Three moose tags.
Yeah, three moose tags. So
heck yes.
I'm not going to have to just deal with one. I'm going to have to deal with two people this year. So, you know, just saying.
Oh, man, that's awesome, Dave. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So in some of the sheep stuff that we were kind of talking about earlier, that's the one that's really having some trouble is the Hunt 3151, the Desert Bighorn Sheep, any legal weapon hunt, that's down 22 tags across the board from 25.
Yeah.
You know, that, and that's kind of to be expected. The biggest one I think that took the biggest hit was the archery.
Right.
The archery only Bighorn Sheep tag, they cut half the tag. So there were 14, now there's 7. They got rid of a couple hunt units, and that one got knocked around quite a bit.
Is it just predominantly because that population is in the southern part of the state and the drought conditions down there? Because
That and the pneumonia.
Oh, and pneumonia. But I look at it overall and I look at like Rockies.
Yeah.
That went up and we've now got an entirely new unit to hunt. For
them, 091.
Right. And then California, they've reopened unit 1, 011, 012, 013.
Yeah.
They've added hunts there. They've added tags there, so it's realistically just Nelson's or Desert Bighorns that are really, really suffering. Or or is that too simple?
No, that's not too simple. That's kind of, I mean, that's your 30,000 foot level
overview.
You know, overview of it. Yeah, they're struggling in some areas, and that is due to the drought.
Yeah,
and you know the water issues that we're having, and then in that area. That was predominantly the archery area, that Tonopah area.
Yeah.
That pneumonia went through a couple years back and really put a hurting on the herds.
Okay.
So, you know, there's that. And then you've got the transmission from the domestic sheep to in some of those areas, like the pancakes and stuff. So that's all playing a part. And now that you've got wild sheep to wild sheep transmission, it's a tough potato. But yeah, like the California's, the new hunt, that new management hunt for the California Bighorn is 18 tags. So, an early, mid, and late, six tags in each one. So
that's so awesome.
That's going to be cool. Rockies, like you said, is up by one tag due to the new unit, 091, which they're opening, and that's only one tag. So whoever gets that is going to have a heck of a hunt.
Yep.
Because that hasn't been hunted in a long time.
Yeah.
They even raised the goat. The mountain goat is up by two tags.
Two resident tags?
Yeah, two resident tags.
Perfect.
102 went up from 14 to 16 tags.
Yeah, okay.
So the other one stayed the same, 2 and 1. And then non-resident goat went up by 1.
Simpleton math here. Rocky, there are 4 tags, right? 2, 1, and 1? Or is it 2, 2, and 1?
For Rocky Mountain?
Yeah.
Rocky Bighorn? It's 1-2-1.
1-2-1. Yeah. So four tags total in the state. So total. It still makes moose the rarest tag in the state with only three.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Big time.
Okay.
And with pretty much everybody equivalent on points.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's true. Fair.
So it probably makes it the toughest tag to acquire.
Right.
So, but, you know, what are you going to do?
What is it? 115 has two?
One for Rockies. 102 has two.
Oh, 102. 115 has one and 091 has one.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
Exactly.
Right on.
For the California as well, you got those two new hunts, the 011 and 013, which is one tag. And then 014 is one tag. And then they split 068. They split that into an early and late. A late.
Yeah.
But that stayed. They just split it three tags and four tags.
So, same number of tags. They just split them up.
The tags actually went up.
Oh, they did.
Yeah. The tags went up by 6 more California tags. Because you got those new hunts.
Wait. Well, Dave, I hear the music. Hang on. I'm going to ask you about that when we come back from break. Right. Do not go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Final segment of Nevada Backcountry on this Sunday. I'm going to jump right back in, Dave, because at the end of that last segment, you and I, over the break, we realized we were talking past each other. My understanding was that 068 had always been seven tags, and they now have just split it up to three and four. So that's what I was talking about. You were talking about overall California Correct. Bighorn tags have gone up, but they have not gone up in 068. So Correct. I was talking 068 without saying it. You were talking it overall without saying it. So it almost came fisticuffs. However,
that's right, man. I was about ready to take off my shirt, start doing some flexing.
All right. So same number of tags as always. They've just split it early and late in 068. And as I've made the comment on the show before, having hunted that unit for sheep, there are two distinct geographic locations where sheep are early and then they are late. So that, in my mind, that's a good thing. What else you got? What about like meat and potato stuff, mule deer stuff?
So like resident junior mule deer, the one tag, the classic.
Classic,
which means if your kid draws the tag, they can hunt the archery season, the muzzleloader season, and the illegal weapon season, as long as you follow the weapon regulations.
Yep.
That one's down 97 tags.
That makes sense in my mind. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the archery primitive weapon, which is archery and muzzleloader, is up 63 tags.
And again, that makes sense. Okay. And that's for the junior hunts.
Correct.
And that's the classic is the way it always, or that's how that junior hunt always was in my world.
Right.
You get archery, you get the whole season.
You get all three seasons.
Bingo.
You just take, and if there's a deer season, you can hunt it.
And it makes sense in my mind to start sliding that scale more towards archery and muzzleloader stuff.
Yeah, because then they have the new one, which is just any legal weapon.
Right.
That's the only season you can hunt, and that one is the same.
Okay.
So
cool.
Yeah. So that's kind of what's going on there. The resident mule deer, any legal weapon hunt, is up by 500 tags.
That's a pile.
That's
and
a
it
pile.
Went up last year, too.
It did. Yeah, it went up just over 500 tags across all units.
Can I do a little bit of, I'll do the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain thing?
Yeah, heck yeah.
Okay, so at that commission meeting that we were at, man, we're heading into a really, really gnarly drought. There's no way to sugarcoat it.
Yeah.
The presentation by the... Oh, man, I forget his name.
He's the habitat staff specialist.
Yeah, he did a phenomenal job.
Oh, he did.
And the data in there was incredible, but it was eye-opening for me to sit there and watch that and go, holy crap, this is going to get ugly. So,
And especially when he compared it to, usually they compare to like the 80s or the 90s or something. He only went back 10 years.
Yeah.
He compared it to data from, the 10-year data. And it's, you're right. It's like, it
was bad.
Nuts.
It's going to be bad.
It's going to be bad.
So a lot of this mule deer numbers, now, I don't want this to come across as like, just want doom and gloom. I mean, it sounds good on the surface for hunters, right? But realistically, what it is they are looking long term. And by they, I mean the habitat specialists and everything.
Yeah.
They're looking long term and going, we got to knock down some of these herd numbers if we're going to have a herd to speak of at the end of this cycle we're going into right now.
Yeah, or over the next 10 years. Because one of the big issues, as they were stating in the presentation, was it is the habitat conversion that's going on.
Correct. Yeah. That sagebrush step is slowly
we've lost, what was it, did he say, like 60% or
70%? I thought it was 71%.
Of our sagebrush habitat since the 80s. 70% of it's gone. And that is the primary thing for mule deer.
Yep.
So the one bonus to that was, as stated in that presentation and the commission conversation, was that it's converting to more of an elk habitat.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's why you're seeing some of these elk herds are just doing really great, and they're getting bigger and they're spreading
out. And antelope, I think, as well.
Was another one that they're taking advantage of this shift in habitat
towards more of a grassland.
The kicker is, as we're losing that mule deer habitat and working on trying to get it back by seeding, by doing, alternative methods, we got to manage that herd because it's being lost quicker than the herds are, in a sense, decreasing. And you don't want, once our herd gets sick and diseased because of starvation, because of, stressors, things like that, it wipes out the whole herd. It's not just like three or four will die and the rest are like, okay, whatever, man, let's move on. No, it annihilates them all. I mean, it just weakens the entire group. Then you're really in a pickle.
That's where we are. And you can't grow that sagebrush steppe or mature bitterbrush habitat overnight. You're talking 20, 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't grow like cheatgrass or something or thistle. No. So, yeah.
Anyway, so tag numbers are up for mule deer.
Yeah. So non-resident mule deer and illegal weapon up just a little over 100 tags for that particular group. And then muzzleloader is up 67 tags. Non-resident muzzleloader is the same, no change in that one. Archery's up just over 80 tags for mule deer archery, and pretty much in those areas you would expect. Area 10, 16 went up, 17 went up. Pine Nuts got a few extra tags, so
woohoo!
So that kind of stuff. Non-resident archery went up by 5 tags, which is fine. Don't need to give them too many tags.
Well, when you talk about that, I agree. But when you talk about that, the areas it went up, those are our mule deer herds, essentially.
Yeah.
Those are the bulk of them, 16, 17, and 10. That's would I be wrong in saying 85% of the state's mule deer live in those three areas?
Probably there, yeah. And then 14 also, the diamonds and stuff.
Yeah, so maybe not 85,
that whole strip right there where, they kind of worked their way through. Area 13, too, their Illipaw area. That was always a pretty solid big group.
Big herd.
So, but, overall, tags went up across the board. And so the total mule deer and pronghorn tags. I'm trying to find my little data sheet here that I have. So in 2025, mule deer and pronghorn tags totaled at 18,744 tags. That's a buttload of tags.
Yeah, it is.
That is really a lot of tags. To this year's 19,664. So up.
Man, that sounds like so many tags to me, but when it's a big state.
It's a big state, but not only that, but you start looking at all the people that are holding these tags. You got 20,000 tags out there.
Right.
The success rates. You got to put the success rate in.
A lot of those units are barely double digits, like 10% success rate.
Oh, if that. Yeah. I mean, there's some in here that are way lower than that. You give out, the reason there's so many tags is maybe the amount of animals that need to be removed off the landscape, 10,000.
Right.
Well, if we hit 10,000, that'd be amazing. But, you take into the consideration the success rates, and it's definitely not, we're not pulling 20,000 animals off the landscape.
No. And maybe people realized this and have realized this forever. But for me, when you and I became friends and started palling around, I didn't realize how much went into this, or it's like Moneyball. Endow is crunching numbers, looking at data from habitat stuff, water, her, there's so many little factors.
Oh man.
That go into this forecasting and prediction model and how many then tags they decide, or they go before the commission and say, hey, this is what we think it should be. Now cabs get their say.
Oh, of course. Yeah. But, and the public, general public.
And the public, yeah.
You know, and the commissions. But yeah, I mean, these predictive models aren't just, it's like, you know, the biologists went out there and said, well, this is what we're doing for this year. These models are predicted out for a while. And then as these trends are developed, you can fine tune those models based right. on actual data that you've received, which includes success rates, you know, wounded animals in the field, because those aren't right. part of the success rate calculation.
Right.
That's why they ask you, like, did you wound any and not recover anything?
Yeah.
That all plays into those algorithms and those models. So it's a lot. That's why it takes, you know, a significant amount of time and an entire year of survey efforts and meetings and conversation with partners and the whole nine yards to get this information to a point where we're helping our habitat. We're determining water situations. Like some of these guzzlers that are going on right now, they're relocating guzzlers because where they were before isn't conducive to where we need them now. In the sense like, hey, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, that guzzler did great. But things have shifted.
It's been dry for a decade now.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're going to upgrade it. Now some of the guzzler designs are like, we went up to those one guzzler in 221 this year. Those brand new ones.
Yeah.
Wow. What a difference compared to that other one that we, when we walked into the wilderness and found that like 1970s guzzler.
Black tarp and
tubing and just like a Homer bucket as a drinker. And you're like, yeah, they've definitely made these way better.
That Means family guzzler build that my family was on up there in Soldier Meadows.
Yeah.
Ah, these new guzzlers are amazing.
They got like 1,500 gallons
of storage capacity. The data they can gather from those little tracker things that the Fraternity of the Desert Bighorn, representative from Fraternity of the Desert Bighorn Sheep. He was up there installing those things, and I picked his brain on them. But these new guzzlers are phenomenal.
Yeah, and the data gets sent right out. I mean, if things start going hinky with it or the water's drying up.
And those are going to affect animal distribution.
Oh,
where those new guzzlers. Hey, good luck to everybody in the draw. Get up, get out, shoot your bows, shoot your guns, and do not go anywhere. Tom Gresham's Gun Talk is coming up next on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk.